Good morning, all you diners and travelers. Some places, stay at home for the most part. People cook at home, also for most people.
Well, we kind of spread out today.
Yeah, well, you're listening to On the Menu with Ann and Peter Haig, and we'll be discussing issues relevant to our current pandemic.
And some people who are contributing to dealing with the unpleasant issues and bring some logic and sense into the whole experience.
Yeah, and there's so many people out there doing things that are thoughtful and admirable, and they're strong.
And we got a couple more of them for you today.
Yeah, starting with Mark Canlis. He has a wonderful story. His family's restaurant is in Seattle, Canlis, which we've had the pleasure of eating at. And, well, he has the story to tell. Let's just let Mark tell us.
I'm so excited to be talking to Mark Canlis. You are what generation, Mark, of Canlises?
Oh, heavens, it depends on how far back that family goes, but I think in the restaurant we're considered the third or fourth generation.
I thought it was four, yeah. So, but I was, of course, I mean, you could give a very short description to our listeners, although they probably don't even need it, about this wonderful Seattle restaurant that has been probably one of the most esteemed restaurants in the whole the United States, if not globally, for how many years now?
For this will be our 70th year.
70th.
So and we started in 1950.
Oh, wow. Somehow I didn't know it was quite that old. But I was caught by the fact, I mean, so much of this is going on in the restaurant world, but you are nimble enough that you guys figured out with this current a situation, who knows how long it will go on, that what you have been is not going to be how it will be in the future, or at least for some time. Can you encapsulate, like, what the Canlis that I know, what it was like?
Sure. So in pre-pandemic times, we looked like your standard fine dining restaurant. So this one started by our grandfather, and my parents ran it for 30 years. I've been doing this with my brother. I've been trying to make it as good a restaurant as we can and, try our best to see if we can't top the lists of, I don't know, good restaurants in the country. And so it looks like white tablecloths and a fancy wine list and a beautiful view and lots of people to dote on you and try to make whatever you're celebrating the best night of your life. And then, of course, these days, what we're doing looks a lot different than that. And so we've made quite a switch that we're not doing fine dining anymore. We just the writing seemed to be on the wall months ago, and we shut the restaurant down in favor of some more creative and perhaps more off-the-wall ideas, in favor of just exercising some of our inner crazy and letting it out. So we became a drive-through restaurant for a little bit. That was a fun season of our life. I think like adolescence is a fun season. It was crazy and wild. And
I can't picture it.
Our restaurant has a porte cochere. It's a French term for fancy term for something you drive underneath.
Exactly.
We greet you that way, but as it turns out, it's perfect for a burger drive-through. So we're also on a busy road, and so it's not. No fine dining restaurant ever dreamed of being built kind of on a freeway. That's not how most Americans think of. But we decided to let out our inner drive-through and to serve burgers and ice cream sandwiches. And we served so many of those, it kind of shut traffic down around the city. It's like eight blocks away from here. We had lines and stuff. So We also opened a bagel shed. We happen to be blessed with a large parking lot, and in it we have a shipping container with a flour mill and a huge hearth wood-fired oven. And so we turned that into a bagel operation every morning and sold, I don't know, 600 bagels in about 45 minutes. And then on day three of this pandemic, we started doing home delivery of various things. So dinner and pieces of our wine list and cocktail kits and boxes full of groceries, you know, community-supported agriculture, CSA boxes, mm-hmm. ways we could support our farmers and put, you know, good ingredients and groceries in the hands of people who didn't want to head out to the grocery stores and that kind of thing. So we've been busy. And,
what about your live streaming piano music? I thought that was
bizarre. Yeah, so, I didn't know if you wanted me to keep going, but one of our guests said, "Hey, these dinners in a box are fantastic, but we would love to have your piano live. That would be a real comfort." So we had hired our piano players as drivers. All of the staff who aren't cooking are delivering these meals, but we pulled them out of their cars and put them in front of the piano and started a live stream, and that's been quite popular. I think we have people around the world watching that now. And from there, one of my staff said, you know, we used to play bingo after service. What if we just did that with the whole city? So after a hard meal, they'd all sit around and drink a beer and play bingo together. How old our restaurant is. I don't want you to think that because we're a 7-year-old restaurant, we play bingo. We just think it's kind of a hoot. And so anyway, we started doing that with the city, and we'll do that again tonight. It's
and you,
8:30
you give
Pacific Standard Time.
$100 canless gift cards and two rolls of toilet paper.
And toilet paper and CSA boxes and anything else. Last week it was like 30 pounds of Valrhona chocolate, you know, things that we're not using as a fine dining restaurant anymore. We'll just sort of raffle those things off. We've had a 2,000 people playing every. We put the bingo cards in the boxes that we send out.
Oh, wow.
Kind of become a fun
thing. I'd love to have been part of the conversation that you had amongst yourselves in the process of redoing this whole entire business plan and defining what canless would be.
You know, you'll be happy to know we were actually sober for the conversations, so it doesn't appear that way from the outside. It really just stemmed out of this idea of, you know, we didn't have the luxury of just sort of financially, we were not able just to sort of close the doors and hold our breath and wait for assistance. It doesn't work for our business model or our family. And we thought, well, what can we do? And we have this incredible team of people, 115 employees. And we just started with the question that said, you know, what do we have, you know, in our grasp right now that we can be thankful for? What do we have that we can actually use? And while to many it may seem off-brand that a company like ours would sort of do these things that are very not fine dining, to us, and it feels like canless is more canless than it's ever been. And the opportunity to be serving people in the city, to be taking meals to the most vulnerable, either or the frontline workers that are fighting this thing, or to just families at home that need a pick-me-up, that need a home-cooked meal, and to not do the dishes and to not have to. It seems like such a privilege, and it's been such a blessing to us to be serving people in this way. It just kind of fills us up.
I was reading, two things. One of them is Gabrielle Hamilton's thing on closing Prune. That was, yeah. I mean, she's a beautiful writer. She writes this probably better than she cooks, I think, to tell you the truth.
She found it in both. I was jealous when I read that thing. I was like, wow, yeah. But such a sad story. And really, that is the story of so many. I mean, I think she was speaking for the people there. So many restaurants who, you know, all of us just caught unaware by this thing, and you wake up the next day and you don't have the ability to open the doors or pay the bills. And I think she encapsulated sort of
the fragility of our
industry. Yeah.
Mark, did you actually own your building?
So we bought it. Yes. Talk to my bank about that. I have a big mortgage. I don't know, when you have a big loan, does that mean you own it or does the bank own it?
That's a good question.
7 years ago. So I think I own a piece of it and I pay a lot of interest on the rest of it. So that was one of the things that we really had to consider was how do we keep paying this mortgage off?
And, right.
You know, PPP and all
that. And what percentage of your employees are you able to support or keep?
Oh, all of them. We've not had to lay off a single employee. Now, we've had a couple sort of choose to stay home who have maybe various means of other income, or they have children at home and are taking care of their kids who, of course, are not in schools. But we made this voluntary from the get-go. We just said, look, we're all going to have different jobs tomorrow. Who wants one? And to a person, they all signed up, every one of them. So that was, again, it's such a we really feel fortunate and blessed to be able to be doing what we're doing and figure out a way to do that safely in a way that actually works for the viability.
Yeah, no, I mean, I read Daniel Wahum. He said he'd spent a lot of time driving around the city, New York, and saw so many people with food insecurity that he began to question whether or not he would really want to have 11 Madison Park be the same, reopen and stay the same.
Gone through such a metamorphosis, and then now, I mean, he was doing so many changes even before this thing, and now that this has hit, I think it's moved him in ways that are redirecting him out of fine dining and more towards, food insecurity was a huge issue in this country before this, and now...
Yeah, I know.
It's just skyrocketing, and I read a survey last night, actually, that Chef sent me just talking about the increased levels of food insecurity for mothers with children 12 and under, and it's staggering. It's somewhere up in the 20% and 30% range in many communities. And so I think all of us, not just the Daniel Humes of the world, but all of us who even play some small role in this economy need to take a real hard look at the impact that we're having and the people that we're serving. Are we playing enough of a role? So if there's a silver lining in all of this, I think it's reminding us exactly how alike we are as people and how we need one another and how, I don't know, maybe our petty differences from the pre-pandemic time are put aside and the things that are more important now come to the forefront. And then it's testing the true metal of who we are.
It started, you're right, before the pandemic hit. I mean, you started seeing like Massimo Bottura, what he was setting up with those for the food insecure. What is he called? I can't remember what he calls them now. All over the world.
What do they call fattorias or something like that?
Fattorias. Yeah. And then you saw the World's Kitchen and Jose Andres rushing from one crisis to the next. So it's been happening, and I think that something along the way clicked before this pandemic that made everybody step back and examine what they were doing in this industry.
Mm-hmm. And I think it's not too soon to be looking at those sorts of silver linings. I mean, look, there's so much that is hard and broken and hurting and devastating right now. And yet this is a time when those of us who are not sick and who do have homes to quarantine in, and this is a time when we get to ask ourselves, what role do we want to play in building a new normal? And like that's to say, everything is up for renegotiation, and there was so much about a pre-pandemic America that I would not choose to go back to. So I think this is a beautiful time to sort of choose the ways that we move forward, and we're doing that as a company, and we're doing that personally. I don't think this is a finger-pointing exercise as much as it is to look at the folks like Jose Andres and say, what is it about that man's character
exactly.
and his decisions that I emulate for myself? And how can I change or use this time to change me? And
aren't you proud of yourselves and the industry as a whole for being able to just jump into a whole new I don't know. I mean, there you are being hit so hard, and the restaurateurs and the chefs are the first ones jumping up to with their hands in the air to volunteer to do all this stuff.
It's enormously impressive to see their work, and I think, I think it's just a reminder. There are so many sort of shining stars coming out in the darkness. You see these people stepping up even when they have nothing, even when they have very little to work with. They're choosing to kind of say, you know what, this is what I have, and I'm going to turn to the person on my right and my left. I'm going to use it to either serve them or encourage them or bless them in some way. And that's who we're taking our cues from, and I think that's what we're paying attention to now. You can only read so many headlines, right, before you just sort of throw your phone against the wall and crawl under your covers and hide. So maybe that's just me. I don't know.
But we talked to a chef owner here in Pittsburgh just a couple of weeks ago, and he said somebody asked him, how long can you keep this going for? Because basically he's feeding every restaurant-related person who comes by. He has a hot meal for them every single day. And he said, his answer was this. He said, until the money runs out.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's really special.
Until the end. When you ask anyone who went through either the Korean War or the Great War, the World War II, anyone who spent any time as a prisoner of war, and you ask them, how long can you do this? There was only one answer. I'm going to do this till the end. I'm going to do it until I have, you know, nothing left to give. And in this way, I think so many of us are put in that position, which is, it isn't about, you know, what day will we turn the economy back on or how long can you do it for? We're all going to do this until we have something else to do. And
so what
Lord willing,
do you
we'll make it that far.
In your particular situation, I mean, what do you see happening in the future? Like when we're no longer in the midst of the tight pandemic, what do you think is going to happen with the industry or with people or what? Your restaurant? I mean, what's going to happen?
Yeah, I keep checking my crystal ball. It seems to have been pretty broken lately.
Mine too.
You know, I think for sure there'll be less restaurants. We're already seeing the fallout,
and that's true.
It's tragic. I think there's going to be a great thinning of the diversity of the places that we have to eat in, and that is tragic. Anytime we're losing, that's the wealth of our nation. That's the wealth of our country. It's the wealth of our heritage as a people, and anytime we see that diversity thin out and narrow down, I think it's tragic, and we need to pay attention to it. So you're going to see that in restaurants for sure. There will just be less places who can either hold their breath long enough until the economy turns back on, or who have the strength to put their companies back together in these new times. I mean, Seattle is talking about letting restaurants open up in a few weeks, and for so many of my friends, we're all just kind of saying, well, that doesn't work. We could barely make a living 100% full. So when you're 25% occupancy,
it's just
places that doesn't pencil out. And that's not to say that the government's doing it right or wrong, but it's the reality of where we're at right now. So I think you're going to see just a lot fewer places, you know, open back up.
Well, that's for sure.
You know what? I feel for sure that whatever happens, Ken Lease will be one of the ones that survive. I just have this kind of sneaking suspicion.
The real worry for me is that the big corporations with all the deep pockets of money are the ones to be able to ride this out, rather than smaller independent hospitality vendors.
You're gonna lose Chick-fil-A
or whatever. You know what I mean?
Small family businesses don't typically have the ability to ride something out like this the way that a larger corporation would. And that's not that we can't blame the larger corporations for that, but I think it's pretty tone deaf if we're not paying attention to the, and they are the fabric of our economy in this country. And so I think we're going to need to figure out a way to to help them and to turn towards them and to serve them in the way that they have been serving the country and so on. So,
you know, I don't admire how you're taking care of your local suppliers and so forth too, because that's the other thing I run up against constantly is people that, I mean, this is the chunk of their living, their existence is restaurants, and they're not there anymore. And what happens?
The bulk of our suppliers are one family running a farm. And suddenly, when 90% of the restaurants you sell to just didn't open their doors, that's a whole family's livelihood. Just chef came to us just a couple of days in, and he said, you know, it's like you just kept hearing about all these dominoes falling, and he said all of our farms are just terrified that we have to keep buying from them. And I was like, well, where are we going to put the food? Like, what are we going to do with it? So that's where the idea of just passing around the CSA boxes came from. It's not even, we don't even mark it up. It's not the idea isn't to make money off of it. It's just to keep passing food, keep some piece of that economy flowing. And that's the good news is everybody's still got to eat. And we do have a strong nation. This, I think, allows people to pay attention to the farmers and to the folks who are feeding us in a better way. And so, again, while it's devastating to see what's happening, I'd just like to focus on the ways that we can make this better and focus on the things that we can improve upon and use this opportunity, use the hurt and the devastation and the tragedy of this time to move forward in a better way. I think that's our responsibility right now. So, as a restaurant, that's what we're trying to do. And there are so many people.
I'm very encouraged by the fact that you've approached this in such a thoughtful, considerate manner. You know, it's just it's a whole different issue for you than it is for a lot of other people, I think.
And I think we have to be careful and, you know, not to – I don't think it's a function of just stuffing your head in the sand, right, and being the ostrich on the beach that refuses to pay attention to – what's going on. But we do have a choice as a people to pay attention to what we pay attention to. And I my own self find myself so tempted to be mired down and depressed by sort of the headlines and the reality of it all. But then when I wake up in the morning, I'm thinking, wait a second, like I have so much to be thankful for. And what am I going to spend my day focusing on? You know, I'm healthy today and my staff is here and we have one more day to serve a city, and maybe tomorrow we'll close, but I'm not in charge of tomorrow. I'm in charge of today, and I got to respond well to that. So as a personal practice, I've just found so much, I don't know, it's been so helpful to start with what I have instead of focus on what I don't have. And I think I needed that reminder before the pandemic, and it's a bummer that it's taken this to sort of beat that into me, but it's that's the story of the last 9 weeks of my life, at least, and a lot of my staff. It's just say, okay, here we go. I wake up every morning and the sky is still up there, and you say, all right, well, it didn't fall down, so there's one thing to be thankful for. And sometimes it feels like that. It feels like you're just claiming almost the most ridiculous things you can to be thankful for, but they're there, and there are two truths. And one is that there's a pandemic swimming across this country and this nation, this world, and there's another truth that the human spirit wants to endure. And if you just give it a chance and you just focus on that light, I think it's really inspiring and empowering.
Well, you've inspired me. I knew I'd love to talk to you, Mark.
I couldn't wait. I was like, no way, I get to be on a show. That's awesome. I just wish we could do it in person, maybe another time, or I could pack up a box.
Oh, yes, another time.
Okra fritters and meatloaf and send it to you. You're a little far away from it. Freeze it or something. But
by the way, I like okra fritters.
I do, too. We were testing them yesterday. I mean, it's kind of a southern thing, but my mom grew up down there.
Yeah.
It's fine if you do it wrong, but if you do it right, they're awesome. Okra is an underestimated vegetable around here.
Yeah, well. Okay, Mark Canlis, I'll be following your story and seeing where we end up, and hopefully we'll talk again.
Do you know what? Thank you for covering that and just for doing what you're doing. It's a reassuring voice, and I don't think we can underestimate kind of the power of your own work and of those that are sort of telling good stories. So I'm thrilled to be on your show.
Okay, after the break, Miss Anne,
yes.
we're going to take a sharp move to the right, approximately 6,500 miles, to pick up another old friend who's dealing with issues related to the pandemic in a different kind of way because they're facing a different kind of challenge.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Welcome back, and next up we're going to be talking to Will Drew, who runs the World's 50 Best Restaurants, and it's new iteration. I just wanted to mention that we're so used to traveling the world, trotting the globe, attending these awards ceremonies such as 50 Best, the James Beard Foundation Awards, Madrid Fusion, all these things, they've all been canceled. So we kind of are learning new things, new ways of going around all of this ourselves. So we wanted to talk to Will because he's doing it in a big way, repositioning the world's 50 best restaurants into the world's 50 best for recovery initiative and fundraising campaign. Do you miss all of that trotting around, Rabbit?
Well, we miss it. A lot of people are missing lots and lots of things.
Yes.
We're certainly not the ones who are most inconvenienced by all this, for sure. But it is interesting to find out that people are thinking beyond the fact that they just have to cancel and saying, how can I do something really constructive and positive with the opportunity available to me? So Will certainly fits that mold, and here he is.
Okay, sweetheart, off you go.
Yeah, well, we're talking to an old and dear friend, Will Drew, about the world's 50 best restaurants, which is having, as the whole world is having, to adjust to a whole new environment when most of the restaurants are closed. You've done a nice shift, though, in terms of focus with this organization, the world's 50 best restaurants, and it's now become the 50 best for recovery initiative and fundraising campaign. Is that correct?
That is correct, yeah. I have been involved in this a long time, and you guys have been covering this for a long time, but we'd never, I guess, thought we'd be in this situation. So it calls for very different measures a new area that we haven't been involved in before, specifically on the fundraising. But we feel that it's very important that as an organization that kind of both represents and is part of and reflects the world of gastronomy, that we can do all we can to help the hospitality sector there, and the restaurant sector in particular, that is suffering.
And they need help, I say, yeah. But isn't it a totally different animal we're looking at from the quantifying or qualifying, I guess, on the restaurants themselves with the awards program to doing the kind of outreach efforts that you're establishing?
Yeah, it's very different. I guess for a number of years, though, we as an organization have tried to be about more than, and have been, I think, about more than just the lists, the lists and the rankings and the awards that we've created and have been running for 18 years, obviously central to what we've done and the kind of pillar of everything else that is built around that. But in recent years, we've tried to do more than that, and we've succeeded in launching a number of kind of elements that reflect the wider interest in gastronomy as a whole, and not just the, you know, the elite restaurants, if you like. And I think this initiative kind of reflects that further, that we're trying to support and connect the whole restaurant industry across the world, rather than just those that are lucky enough to have been voted into the list in recent years.
And tell me,
what do you call it? Will, do you call it a sabbatical? What, I mean, how
I mean, we haven't given that a name, but I guess, well, we've just decided that this year is not the right year to be, or it's not the right time to be releasing a global ranking when so much of the global restaurant sector is shut, albeit temporarily, we hope. Yeah. And we hope and pray that many of the restaurants that are closed are able to reopen, but of course not all of them will. But also,
yes,
because the world
sure.
is fighting a different kind of a battle, and I think, you know, it doesn't seem, it felt more appropriate to put our efforts into trying to help the restaurant industry by using, you know, the network that we have, and by using the relationships with the chefs and restaurateurs who are lucky enough to have been part of this list, to see how we and they could collectively can help the wider restaurant sector and the up and coming restaurants and the small independents that are, you know, feeling the brunt of this crisis.
And now, talk to us about the structure. I mean, we were looking at this as a kind of a global community or committee of mm-hmm. the judges, individual judges, traipsing around, eating at all these restaurants all over the world. Now, you have to have a different scenario and a different cast of characters for this new initiative, right?
I guess, but we have a lot of, I guess we're using the connections and the audience we have across the world. So the connections we have with the restaurant sector mean that some of the fundraising activity is based around utilizing the time and skills of the chefs and restaurateurs who have been part of this list, partly to produce, a home recipes cookbook that people can will be able to download for a small donation, for a small minimum donation come June. And then secondly, to the chefs and restaurateurs and bars and bartenders from the world's 50 best bars list are putting together some kind of out of this world experiences, gastronomic experiences that money would usually not be able to buy. That might include, one-on-one masterclasses with the chefs, or some wine tasting with the sommelier that you wouldn't usually be able to do, where they open up some of the very special wines, or touring the food markets of the city where the restaurant's located alongside the chef and eating in their favorite local places.
So these are all fundraising initiatives, really.
Yeah, these are all fundraisers that people can buy in an auction that will take place in June and July. So
and
those sorts of things.
Now is starting to sell hamburgers.
Yeah.
Did you read Noma's opening up to sell hamburgers?
Yeah, two hamburgers on the menu, and you can come and eat them outside with some wine.
Yes,
and
exactly. On a special bun.
Yeah. But we're trying to reach the food lovers across the world who maybe have a little money and who want to use that money to help the restaurant sector and globally.
Well, how's it being received?
But they're getting something in return.
How's it being
received? So far, it's been received extremely well. Yeah,
what
it's early days.
Saying?
We're just putting this together. People are very positive about it, because I think anything that we do that looks at recovery, we've been in the restaurant sector's in survival mode, and we'll continue to be in survival mode for a while, but we want to look forward to when it can come out of survival mode and into recovery mode, and try and help that recovery process as best we can. I think the people understand that. They understand that this is that releasing a list would not necessarily be the most important thing on people's minds at the moment, and instead we're focusing on how we can get back to that place.
Yeah, James Beard, which I guess is the most similar to what it is you're doing, they just put off their announcement until September, right, sweetheart?
Yeah, but they're going to still award these ratings for the 2019. Mm-hmm. So they're not canceling the whole thing.
I understand, and it's retrospective, and you know we might do similar things with certain of our other lists in different regions. We've done that, and that we released a list of Asia's 50 best restaurants not so long ago, and of Asia's 50 best bars. But the global list and awards ceremony is such a high-profile event across the world, and the world is in such an uneven situation.
Oh, yeah.
You know, all countries are suffering, but some so much at different stages on the journey than others, and some so much more severely than others, that it's kind of, you know, it might be okay in one place, but to talk about restaurants, you know, high-end restaurants, but it wouldn't be in another. So, you know, I mean, the U.S., as you know, is obviously in a very tough situation with regard to the restaurant sector.
Did you read the interview with Daniel Hume, where he was saying that basically he spent a lot of time driving around New York and noticing that all the food insecure people, so he's thinking of doing the kind of thing like Massimo does.
Undoubtedly, the this sort of situation makes people rethink their whole reason to be, why they do what they do. It's going to make people think deeply about what they want to do going forward, and I'm sure there will be changes. It's very difficult to know what those changes will be in the long term, in the restaurant sector and food. But we'll hope that out of this sort of crisis can come some positives in terms of, you know, sustainability and awareness and so forth.
Yeah, I mean, clearly it's never going to be the same, is it? When the restaurants
come back. I don't think it will ever be the same.
Pardon?
No, it's not going to be the same. But how it's going to be different is difficult to tell. We get a little visibility on how things might be different in the coming months. But we, you know, when we're talking the coming years, when people can travel again and people can maybe eat in close proximity and gather in larger groups, I don't think it'll just return to pre-pandemic. Well, the whole world and society as a whole will not just return to normal. But how it changes, still very difficult to judge.
That's poor old Daniel Hume with a new restaurant just opened, right? A brand swanky new place.
Yeah.
Well, yeah. Lots of people who just opened.
Have you been there? Have you been there, Will?
Of course. I've been to the new London restaurant, yeah.
That's the one I met, yes.
Yeah, very... Very impressive, and very, great restaurant with great hospitality, as you would expect from Daniel and his team. But yes, as you say, many restaurants that have, you know, recently opened or just opened for even like a day or a week and then had to close. It's everything on hold, including, by not just our awards and our list, which is not so important in the grand scheme of things, but I think the whole hospitality sector on a sustained pause. We just hope that they can
except for the landlords. I know New York, that's the big issue here is the landlords and the rent.
You know something, the places that are real, like the Waterside Inn, they'll go on forever.
I would hope so, but you never know, because you know it's very difficult to know what the structure is behind the scenes of any restaurant unless you know the sort of the details of any finances and the backing.
Are you privy to any big never never opening again news about restaurants in, say, London or New York or someplace?
No, I can honestly say that I'm not. And, you know, I hope that doesn't happen. Of course, in reality, it's likely to happen with some big restaurants. But, you know, maybe in some cases it might be that people just decide that that actually they want to do something new, they want to go in a different direction, this gives them pause for thought, so maybe they'll rethink, and some people will open different styles of restaurant instead. But what we do know about the chef and restaurant community is they're very dynamic, incredibly passionate and determined, and there will be a bounce back from that sector. It may look very different, and there may be different values in there, but the restaurant community will bounce back because it has so much creativity, passion, determination. I mean, even just witnessing, in the U.S. in particular, the speed at which restaurants, changed direction to focus on takeout and delivery in many cases, by no means in all cases, but in many cases, and helping to feed those that were in need, has been extraordinary to witness, really.
It's amazing, isn't it? I mean, here's this industry with such a small profit margin, and they're the first ones with their hands up to help. It's just amazing. It makes me happy.
Is it like that in
it's
London?
It's the innate hospitality, I guess. Of people, that's what people think. Sorry.
What's it like in London? Will people doing the same thing? Are they lining up behind the people?
They're lining up to help people for sure. Yeah, I don't think there's as strong a takeout and delivery culture in the UK, and it hasn't. So less people have gone down that route. Less restaurants have gone down the route, but in terms of moving towards, or in terms of putting their hands up to help others, absolutely, that's been very prevalent and very evident. And yeah, it's heartwarming to see that the hospitality industry is truly hospitable. It, you know, people go into this business because they like that idea of making other people happy, in its fundamental sense. That's kind of why people cook and
now where
and why people
you have serve. Like a committee. You're going to raise all this money. Who determines where the money goes? What's the most effective?
So we're in the
money.
We've just set up an independent trust. It's like a not-for-profit called the Best Recovery Recovery Fund, and that all the money that we raise will go into that, and then all the money will go out of that. In that, there's no administration fee. It's set up by the company behind 50 Best, but it's independent of 50 Best in that there's no cost against it. We are in the process internally of, trying to shortlist not non-profit organizations around the world that we think are aiding the restaurant sector most effectively. Now, that's a difficult call, of course, and we can only, we don't have perfect knowledge of that. We can only go on what we're recommended, but we're using our network of academy chairs who head our voting panels around the world, mm-hmm. for them to recommend to us what they think are the most effective and deserving, charity organizations that are helping the restaurant sector and will help the restaurant sector to propel its recovery in the coming, months and even years. So we're going through that process. It's not an easy process to judge, but we will, we're doing our best to do our due diligence on all those organizations. And we'll publish that.
It's nice that Sam Pellegrino and Aquapana signed on again, huh?
Yeah, absolutely. And, we've been gratified by the support of Sam Pellegrino and all our sponsor partners who want to, stand together with 50 Best and with the restaurant community in order to support them. It's important for them, of course, it's their business as well that has to keep going. It's important that they support and are seen to sort of help the industry as a whole.
Well, I mean, what you wonder, chefs are so focused on striving for that number one slot on the list. What would be the equivalent for them in the new structure?
What, the initiative? Yeah, I mean, I suppose, I mean, they just, I would think that they would just want to refocus that on raising as much money. And so if they can provide outstanding experiences that really capture the imagination of the kind of, you know, the global dining public who go, well, you know, I'm prepared to bid and bid big money for this experience, then that will be a success in itself. You know, the more pounds and dollars that we can raise, the better it is for everybody. So that's the focus, and I think chefs and restaurateurs will be focused on helping as much as they can. Of course, they have to look after their own business first and foremost.
Yeah.
That's a given. They've got to look after their employees and their business and try and ensure that's healthy. But we're not asking them for money. We're asking them for their time and you know, their sort of access to them and their expertise, which people are very excited about because most people don't get to meet and spend time with and learn from.
What kinds of ranges are you thinking of? Like if I wanted to have a little meal with Aldo Somme and Bernardin and an intimate wine tasting, I mean, are we talking how many figures do you think it'll go to?
I mean, difficult to know, and we haven't done this before, so we don't know. But I mean, you know, I think if you can get, for example, if Aldo could take you to his wine bar and you tasted some of his rarest vintages in there over an hour in the afternoon or in the early evening or something, that would be a really privileged thing to do. If Aldo then took you to Le Bernardin and, you know, and Chef Repair was there and talked you through the menu and the courses himself, and you had some of the wines that you've been tasting earlier with the dinner, and I don't know, there are other elements you could add to that.
We've been lucky because we already did that.
Yeah. But look, you and I are
It sounds like fun, doesn't it?
Exactly. And we hope we're going to get, you know, five-figure bids on that minimum, and, you know, hopefully plenty more.
Now, time-wise, I mean, what will trigger the start of this? I mean, there's so much nobody knows, and it's kind of creeping around the world, continent to continent and country to country. And when do you launch all this?
We're actually launching the fundraising kind of period. Will start in June, so in a few weeks' time, okay. And we will run that for as long as we think there's still value. So while we've still got something to offer, and we'll run that. But the main auction will probably take place from mid-June to mid-July. Be an online global auction where you can bid for these experiences during that period. We'll, you know, do lots of kind of marketing around that to get as many people interested as possible. And obviously great that, you know, we can broadcast this on various media channels. And, you know, we're looking to do a big, what we're calling a recovery summit in September, which will be an online conference and talks and panel discussions and master classes and interviews and so forth, where we're trying to bring the world of gastronomy together to look at how we, you know, what people have learned and what the future might look like, and how our restaurants can learn from each other to survive, and what it'll feel like for diners going forward. So,
it's, you know, a big job.
We're hoping to create content around that too.
Well, this is huge. I think one of the things that we've learned in the U.S. is it's not all that easy giving money away to the right lot of places. You know that.
Absolutely. I completely agree and understand that. It's a challenge.
So you have a huge
sure,
undertaking but, ahead of you. I think you do. You're going to be a very busy man.
Yeah. Well, you know, right? Keeping us busy, which is good. Keeping the whole team busy, which is even though we're working from home, we're still working extremely hard. But you know, it's rewarding to try and help something. You know, it's an industry that we all feel very much a part of. So you know, we of course want to help it to not only survive but to thrive again.
Tell us the big party will be back next year, please.
Well, I really hope so.
Cheers up.
I mean, the big party was it was going to be in take place in Antwerp in Flanders,
Belgium. We just stopped short of buying our tickets, actually, our plane tickets.
Well,
we just stopped short.
I'm glad you didn't. But hopefully we're just going to postpone that until next year. So we will take place there again,
and we'll be
probably, we hope, in June 2021. And God willing, we'll all be able to travel there and enjoy it. But, you know, we'll see. We'll have to take that as it comes.
Are you quarantined at home, or what are you doing, you personally?
Yeah, we're just beginning in the UK to ease some of the restrictions, but we're all still working from home in my industry, and we'll be for another month or so, I suspect. We're still effectively on lockdown. There's a little bit of an easing of some of the restrictions, but generally most people are still on lockdown at least till the end of this month.
Yeah, I just noticed we're getting quite a lot of press material from London. I noticed that Koya just extended their opening hours, and they're now going to deliver lunch too. So they're getting up in the morning and trying to figure out what they can do next to make their life more interesting.
Absolutely,
and to make it something that
some people are enjoying it. We just interviewed Mark Canlis. You know, Canlis is in Seattle, a 70-year-old business. And boy, in a matter of days, they pivoted, as they're saying now. They call everything pivoting.
Yeah.
But, I mean, they changed their whole business model, their whole restaurant concept, the whole everything in a matter of days. And they keep discovering new and creative ways of working around the strictures. So anyhow, you're going to have a good time, and you're going to be very busy. So I thank you for taking the time to talk to us. And it's good to have
Not
a connection still, because I'm missing our 50 best people.
So if you have a scoop about something new,
it's always a pleasure to talk to you guys.
Let us know.
I will do, yeah. Thank you both very much.
Thank you, Will. Bye-bye.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Here we are again, and of course the other side of this coin is a lot of people aren't traveling. They're not going out to restaurants. So what are they doing? They are cooking at home. And they're cooking a lot of pasta at home. And to tell you the truth, it seems, from what I read. And we ran across this one brilliant idea. So you get your veggies and you get your pasta. It's called Veggie Craft from Veggie Craft Farms. And we're going to be talking to Aaron. It's a bird. It's playing as a Fasano.
Yeah, well, we're talking to Aaron Fasano. Nice name, Aaron.
Thank you.
It means what in Italian?
I think it means it's a type of bird. I'm not sure, actually. It's
Pheasant. Yeah, there it is. So we're talking to Aaron Pheasant, which is very good to eat. It's pretty, too. Anyhow, we're not talking about that. We're talking about a veggie craft and veggie craft farms. Is Veggie Craft Farms a place as well as a company?
It's not, actually. It's the name of our brand, but it's actually an Italian. Our products are actually made in Italy. So I'm Italian, and so is our product. So that's kind of fun.
Yeah, me too. So we're on the same page. Great.
It's interesting because we associate pasta with Italy. Most of the people we met in Italy, including people who actually make pasta in very large quantity, and we're always taught to assume that it's durum wheat from Abruzzo is what you're supposed to use, or at least a semolina or something like that made from the fruit of the durum wheat, and now we've got something entirely different.
Yeah, talk to us about whose idea? It's not a place; it's a company. And what's the background of the company, and when did it get started? Tell us a little bit about that.
Sure. So Veggie Craft Farms is a brand actually owned by a company called Brandable, which is a CPG company really started by millennials for millennials. So the founder of our company is actually named Oliver Bogner. He started the company with sort of a vision to bring products that would be more exciting and more interesting to younger consumers. And so we have brands that kind of range all different product categories. One of our other big brands besides Veggie Craft is called Queen V, and it's a feminine hygiene brand. But Veggie Craft Farms is our flagship food brand. And this was really born out of Oliver's own gluten intolerance. So he really wanted to bring gluten-free, vegetable-based products that were more fun and more interesting to center store. And so we started with pasta. We've also made macaroni and cheese. We make rices now, and we're working on, for later in the year, we're actually going to debut at Natural Products Expo East. We're going to bring for the very first time our new lineup of snacks. So they're like crunchy snacks, but they're all gluten-free, cauliflower-based, and really, you know, so you get that sort of salty, delicious snack flavor, but from something that's a little more healthy for you. So it's kind of a fun background.
Do the cauliflowers of the world give you applause as you walk by?
Does the what?
Do the cauliflowers of the world applaud as you walk by?
We're eating them.
The ones, the sample passes that you had us try, the cauliflower was the one I liked the best.
Yeah. I think the way that we formulated them as well, you know, it doesn't hit you over the head with too much vegetable flavor, which we hear a lot from moms is really great. You know, younger moms, like I'm 37, I have a 4-year-old and a 5-year-old, and making them eat vegetables is pretty difficult. We hear from a lot of moms that they appreciate how it still kind of tastes like regular pasta, but they feel better about offering it to their kids because there's a little bit of added protein and they know they're getting vegetables. So.
Right. Now, it's since it is veggie-based, it's probably just how many different health benefits does that bring? I mean, it's lower in calories, it's gluten-free, right?
Yep. So our products are gluten-free. They're non-GMO certified. They also have more protein, more fiber, and fewer carbs than traditional pasta. So there's a lot of...
I hope so, because I've been eating it cold. I mean, as a snack, you know.
Yeah, and I actually tried using our Veggie Craft cauliflower penne in a pasta salad recipe, and it still was pretty good, too. So we're kind of trying to find, like, fun new ways to integrate pasta, especially now. You know, people are at home, they're cooking more. So we want to, you know, we're trying to build new recipe ideas for people who are, you know, maybe you're just used to only eating pasta marinara. Well, we can give you some new ideas, new ways to use pasta as well.
When we did the first, the cauliflower, We did it with a squid with kind of a marinara dressing.
Mmm, that sounds delicious. How did you do
it? It was really very good. Yeah. I was afraid, but as you said, I mean, just thinking about squid and cauliflower didn't kind of ring it. The chime off the top of my head here, but it turned out to not be so overwhelmingly
really
cauliflower. It was excellent,
We had that fabulous tomato sauce with it, too.
That's a good one.
We got this tomato sauce that's spelled, the name is spelled like tomato backwards.
It is tomato backwards.
And it's got all kinds of interesting ingredients in it.
Yeah, they're actually sort of our official sauce partner, so we do a lot of partnerships and programs with them. Yes, they're natural, health oriented. Yeah, they're our preferred sauce. So that's funny that you happen to. Where did you find it?
They sent it to us.
when they sent us the sauce, and so we had one of those. And then I had the squid came from
Gulo Seafood.
Gulo Seafood from Long Island, and it was really nice. It was really very good.
We demolished about 4 pounds of squid in 2 nights.
whole box of the pasta.
I had an intelligent question.
Okay.
On the box, it says the product in here, I'm paraphrasing, is made of cauliflower flour, pea flour, and another vegetable flour. Now, are they all kind of mixed up together?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so it's lentil flour is the third flour. They're all sort of mixed up together with water and then formed into the pasta shapes at our facility, which is, as I mentioned, it's in Milan. They can do all different.
Another question.
Mm-hmm.
The people who, what's the name of that pasta made in Abruzzo, where the guy was so informative.
Oh yeah, with starts with a
B, but he stressed the importance of pasta being extruded through bronze dyes, none of this plastic dyes that people like Kraft use in making their pasta, because nothing sticks to it. And if you have a bronze dye to extrude the pasta, then that helps the sauce to cleave to the pasta. Now, do you use bronze dyes or plastic ones?
I honestly don't think that we use dyes, but I wouldn't be able to answer that question without making a phone call.
No, I mean how you get the shape, right? You extrude, you push it through. Some of you extrude it.
Yeah,
through a shape,
like through a piece of equipment. Yeah, I don't know the answer to that question.
You better get us an answer so we can put it on the website.
Sorry about that.
So, I mean, how lower in calorie count is this pasta? Since I've been eating a lot of it.
that's a good question. Let's have a look really quick. So our pasta is 190 calories a serving, and Barilla's similar item is 200 calories. So it's roughly the same number of calories, but what you get from our pasta is more protein, more fiber. So there's more good stuff in the calories that you're eating from Veggie Kraft Farm.
So and the protein comes from pea flour?
Mm-hmm.
And lentils too, right?
And lentils, yeah. I guess, yeah.
And cauliflower's got good stuff in it as well.
Yeah, cauliflower has a lot of interesting health benefits. But people, you know, especially now, people are really interested in eating more plants and eating more protein. And so we really focus on the plants and the protein because that's, I think, what most consumers right now are interested in finding ways to eat more of.
Right. And if people don't like
that. How do people get this? I mean, it's I think when you contacted us, you were just introducing this into the United States, right?
Yeah, so we launched last summer, but that we were only available direct to consumer from our website, veggiecraftfarms.com. You could still get it there. But in November, we really launched in grocery stores across the U.S. through the Albertsons Safeway chain. So you can find us in just about every Albertsons Safeway. We're also in Sprouts. Those are the two big national chains that we're in. And then regionally, you could find us at Meijer if you live in the, you know, the Michigan, Minnesota area. You could find us in Hy-Vee if you lived in the middle of the country there in, like, Kansas City and St. Louis. And we're kind of launching in adding more retailers all the time. Coming up soon here, we'll be adding Whole Foods later in the year. So, you know, slowly but surely, we're adding more and more retailers. But Amazon and our own website are a great place to find it, especially now when it's harder to go out and, you know, and just shop the grocery store. Yeah.
Right. And your factory is in Milano?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Right. I guess they were pretty hard hit, huh? No production issues?
We got really lucky with that. You know, our plant took very, you know, food manufacturing is already a very highly regulated and sort of a, you know, there's a lot of precautions just taken already because it's food and people eat it. So we got really lucky in that we had brought a lot of product forward, and our plant to this point has been able to operate without interruption.
Oh, that's great. So give us a quick recount of the products in this Veggie Craft Farms line.
Sure. So in our pasta line, we have sort of three varieties. So you can either get pasta made with cauliflower, made with zucchini, or made with sweet potato. All of the flavors come in spaghetti and penne. And then the cauliflower also comes in an elbow and linguine shape. So I think that's eight total different varieties of pasta. We also make rice. We have five flavors of rice. There's sort of an original flavor, which you could treat kind of like an orzo or like a side dish. And then there's four other varieties that include a little flavor packet, like a pesto. We have a Mediterranean, and both of those you just add water in the flavor packet. And then we have two cheese options that kind of act like a macaroni and cheese, but of course it's rice. So there's a four cheese, which has more of a nutty flavor profile to it, and then a cheddar cheese, which you can imagine what a cheddar cheese would taste like.
Yes.
And then we have... Yeah, and then we have a line of microwavable pasta cups that are, you know, kind of like a kids-type product. Those are sold in Walmarts nationwide, so we're in about 2,000 Walmart stores on that product. So we have the elbow macaroni made with cauliflower or sweet potato with a cheddar cheese packet. Then we also have elbow macaroni with a marinara packet. So there's a couple of options for the kiddos. And then, as I mentioned, we'll be launching snacks here, Expo East, which is in September, out your way. I think it's in Philadelphia.
You hope.
Yeah. Well, we'll see. So far, we're still planning on it. But if that happens, we'll be sort of bringing to the trade for the first time our lineup of snacks, which will be four flavors. They're really, really, you know, crunchy and yummy, and they still deliver all that sort of savoriness that you want.
Oh, they taste good, these snacks?
They're delicious. My favorite one is the one we've created, a garden salsa, like kind of like we're calling it a crisp. It's sort of a circular, like, chip type thing, and it's so good. It's my favorite one.
Oh, well, send us some of those. Try that. We'll do it again.
Yeah, that sounds good. We'll definitely do that.
Okay. Well, I really was really happy to discover this, because a lot of the stuff that we get, the healthy, gluten-free stuff, mainly tastes like cardboard. So I was really pleased that this turned out to be such a good thing. I thank you for taking the time to talk to us about it.
Yeah, thank you guys for having me. I'm glad you enjoyed it. We'll come back with some snacks when we're ready for you.
Yeah, well, tell me is there anything else that you think that our listeners should know about the brand?
No, I don't think so. But it's definitely, you know, find us at veggiecraftfarms.com or on Instagram. You can find us at veggiecraftfarms. You can get the latest news and updates and see some fun recipes.
Great.
Well, that's about it for this week.
Yeah, it sure is.
There's plenty of things going on. Lots of information, lots of creativity. The worst spotting all over the place.
And we're going to have some more of that.
next week, same time, same place.
Could be a liquid variety. I'm not sure just yet.
Yeah, we'll see.
Whatever it is, we're sure you'll enjoy it, and we hope you'll then be a part of our audience once again. And
till then,
goodbye.
Bye-bye.